Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of the first season of Local Folks Podcast. My name is Bob Madar, and today we're going to spend the entire time talking with someone you've already met, a hospice patient who, in the interest of confidentiality, we've called Margaret. Patients like Margaret are the focus of everything Lumina Hospice and Palliative Care does, and the goal is to provide Margaret and patients like her with compassion, comfort, and support to help them live out the rest of their lives on their own terms, among people who care. I interviewed Margaret at her home, and prior to my visit, Margaret had been creating a life review with support from a hospice volunteer. And I asked her to share some of what she'd been writing. Oh, by the way, there was a crew working on the gutters of the house while I was there, and you'll probably notice some talking in the background, hammering, and other construction-related noises. And I hope they don't distract you too much from what Margaret has to say.
Dear friends and family, I've been thinking about my life and the things that have happened. I was born in April of 1924. I was the youngest of four. My two oldest brothers and sister were James and Evelyn, who were 18 and 16 years older, and my brother Paul was 7.5 years older. My mother, Catherine Fielding Hunter, was 44, and my dad, James E. Hunter, was 49 when I was born. Dad spoiled me terribly by eating all the things I didn't want on my plate. My brother, Paul, would take me on his bicycle to the Mad River where he fished, and telling me in a very short manner, "Don't talk. Shh. Be quiet. Stand still." The Arcata Redwood Company was only about a mile from our home, which was at 18th and G Street in Arcata. My dad owned a grocery store on the corner of 11th and G Street, and my sister Evelyn at that time would deliver orders to his customers. She was in college at Humboldt's Teachers, and in 1930 was able to go to the Olympics in Amsterdam. And so my dad told her if she could win her way to New York, he would pay her way on the ship going over. And when she came back from Amsterdam, she brought me my Dutch doll,
which I
still have. And it was decorated in the typical Holland attire with the little black hat and the lace top and the skirts and the wooden shoes. So I have that. She sits in a wicker rocker chair that I used to sit in. My mother would have friends in and they would be doing embroidery work or sewing. And I was in a little chair and I was told to be quiet, but I did little quilt blocks. So I learned to sew.
Margaret's mother had a restaurant in the family store, and when Margaret was in the eighth grade, she would often come down to help out with the lunch crowd. I asked Margaret to describe a typical lunch menu.
Mother had a certain type of food. It was all one, and the price was 35 cents for lunch and 50 cents for dinner, but the food that she would serve was usually a roast and a full meal. And she would make 6 to 8 pies every morning, so she had fresh pie. There was always a cream pie, a berry pie, and then an apple pie. So she was very busy in the mornings getting ready for the noon meal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go back to school. I liked music very much. And I learned to play the flute and saxophone. When I was in the high school band and orchestra, and the band was invited to San Francisco area each year, I played the bass saxophone for the opening of the Bay Bridge, 1.7 miles, in 1940.
In 1940, wow.
I had new shoes, and my feet sure did hurt the next day.
Going across the bridge?
Going across the bridge.
So.
I finished high school in May of 41, and I started college but quit and went to work for the Bank of America as a bookkeeper, where I met Harold Butler and Fay Cook, who was my bridesmaid.
So here's a question I have for you, and what was it like for you? In 1941, you would have been how old in 41?
I was 16.
You were about 16 in 41. What was it like for you when the war broke out? What kinds of things happened for you at that point? Because that was a huge change in the country.
I was 15 in April. I was then 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go up to the college, and they had a tall dormer on Humboldt State College where we would watch the Japanese boats come into the bay. So we would watch and tell anyone that needed to know that those ships were coming into the bay and to push them out.
So this is like a coastal watch kind of a
yes,
thing?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Because we could see the ocean out.
From the dormer.
From the dormer of Humboldt State College.
At one point while Margaret and I were talking, I remarked at how beautiful the ranch looked as I drove up to the house for the interview. And that led Margaret to reminisce and reflect on how the family came to live at the ranch.
We loved the ranch when we came up here to look at it. And when we came, my dad came up and he walked all over the ranch acreage to make sure that it was the right place for his baby to come.
Oh, that's great.
And my mother came up and looked at the house because this was built in 1956. And she came up and she looked and said, oh, yes, and look at the molding on it. So it was approved. After we moved here, my dad phoned one day and he said, have you named the ranch? And I said, no. And he said, does Lee have a name for it? And I said, no, but I'll ask him. He was in the house. I said, Lee, do you want to name the ranch? He said, no, if he's got a name, that's fine. So he says, well, since you're the only lady there, you're the Lone Star, so it's the Lone Star Ranch. So I'm the star of this
ranch.
You
are the star of the ranch. That's At this point, Margaret began to talk about why it was so important for her to be at home at the end of her life.
I look around my home,
mm-hmm.
and there are so many religious items that have been given to me,
mm-hmm.
and my home has been blessed by the priest in Corvallis. So all the rooms are blessed. Like I say, this is the room I want to be in.
Well, I would imagine as you look around the room, there are so many things that have memory attached to them, I would
right.
think.
And have been given to me.
Have been given to you.
In right? fact, those chairs and another one in the front room
mm-hmm.
were Dorothy's. This couch was Dorothy's. When she moved up from San Diego,
mm-hmm.
she brought them with her. And that poor couch has seen better days.
It goes still looking pretty good, though.
It goes clear to the floor. There's nothing to keep you up. Oh.
One of the things that they talk about is how important it is to be in your home with things that mean something to you.
Right.
And give you a connection to other people.
Right.
And I hear you as I listen to you and stuff. I mean, just those baskets, for example, up there, you know, those are from your childhood in a
yeah.
way and can take you back
right.
to that.
And I have all my pictures up on the rack here.
Mm-hmm.
That was Ken and his bride, Nancy. They were married back at Disneyland. And that's their daughter at 3.5 years old.
Oh, we don't know.
And then another picture of him with Nancy.
Those are very nice pictures.
And then my other kids are all along up here.
So another thing, it seems to me, where you're sitting right now, as you look around the room, in some ways it's like you see your life history here, in a way. Would that be adequate?
That's right. That picture was Lee's dad's picture.
I'll be
down. And when he lived with us, he brought it down here. And we put it up above the television. And that was the Columbia River before the bridges were or
yeah, run, absolutely.
So, and then I look at it and I see the cross and I think, yes, God, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something every day that is very fundamental with my religion.
No kidding. And so, so what I think, as I'm, if I'm hearing this right, two things. One, there are things here that you see every day that are fundamental to your religion, and then there are things here that you see every day that are fundamental to your family.
Right.
And does that give you? Is that something that that is calming and reassuring to you?
Yes. My religion is such that I know God's will be done.
Mm-hmm. 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 And that seems to give you, you seem very at peace to me.
I am at peace.
Right.
I don't have any pain, although I was very ill after I had the water on my lungs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they didn't think I was going to live. But you know, there's a little Irish in me.
That's good.
I can still kick.
I can still kick. That's good. That's
so, very good. No, my little shamrocks hanging up there.
That's great.
All the different things on my whatnot there.
I asked Margaret how many grandchildren and great-grandchildren she had, and with the assistance of her granddaughter, she counted them up. As I listened to the two of them talking, I realized that I was witnessing the end result of the support Benton Hospice Service provides to patients and their families that give them the opportunity to reflect together on the patient's life and legacy.
So you have five kids. Dawn doesn't have any. Tom. How many does Tom have?
He had three.
Yep. And then their three had?
Two each.
Three. So Sarah has, or Sarah doesn't have any. Katie has one. And Kevin has?
Two.
Yeah. So then we go to Bill. How many does Bill have?
Four.
Josh and Justin. Me and Carly.
Yeah.
So how many great-grandchildren are there?
That's nine.
So, yeah, because Josh has two. Justin has one. I have three. And Carly has two.
So those are great-grandchildren.
That's eight grandchildren on that one.
Whoa.
And then we go to, oh, I mixed those up, Ken.
Yeah.
Ken has
two with kids. Your grandchildren.
No, they'll be your grandchildren. And then we go to Jack. And Jack has how many?
He had seven.
Yeah, seven. And Cassandra has?
Two. One now.
Just the one that was just born.
Yeah.
So those are, that's your family and grandchildren there.
Yeah.
Wow, so how many total then?
So there will be, so there's five boys that had 16 grandchildren.
Wow.
And then the 16 grandchildren make two from Dawn that have passed. They passed at infancy, mm-hmm. but those mm-hmm. are your grandbabies. So we have 12 great grandchildren.
Congratulations. Wow. That is an achievement. My goodness gracious.
Well, it was achieved because I could kick.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Well, that just about wraps up this episode, and I must say I really enjoyed my conversation with Margaret. At this point, I'd like to introduce the question that I'm using as the focus of these podcasts. What can the experiences of patients near the end of their lives and the people who care for them and love them tell us about what is important in living and dying? And as I think about my conversation with Margaret, I've learned several things that relate directly to this question. Number one, at the end of life, a life review is a good way to reflect and take stock of your life. Two, it can be very meaningful to spend your last days at home surrounded by things that remind you of your past and the people who are important to you. And three, it's really important to be close to and in the presence of family and friends at the end of your life. Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you'll return for episode 3, when we'll spend the entire time talking with Kayla, a wise young hospice worker, to find out what she has learned about living and dying from her work with hospice patients and their families. For more information, please visit luminahospice.org.
KBOO Portland.